to the January meeting of the New England Fishery Management Council. The current agenda is yellow in color. Hopefully there aren't too many more changes to it. But does anybody have any changes, additions, deletions to the agenda? Seeing none, we will move along into the reports section. I have just got a couple of items. We have not had an executive committee meeting since the last time we met. I think, as most everybody knows, this is Paul's last council meeting, and I noticed this morning he's smiling a lot more than I've seen him in the past. There will be, and I'm not sure where it is, somewhere here in the hotel, that downstairs Karen is pointing, there will be a reception for Paul down there this evening, and it'll be a Dutch treat, and I think there's going to be a cake to say goodbye to Paul. Along the line of personnel issues, I think all of the, probably everybody already knows, so I don't need to announce it, but we went through the interview process yesterday for the final candidates for executive director, and I am very pleased to announce that the council picked Tom Neese as the successor to Paul. Tom was here helping set up, and then I think he went back
to the building.
Yeah. So we'll see how that works out. Just jumping ahead to tomorrow, I wanted to give folks a heads up under the Groundfish Committee report. It is my intention not to take the extensive public comments that we had during the December 20th meeting. I am sure there will be public officials and or their representatives here tomorrow at the meeting. We will take comments from them and a limited number of other comments from the public. So I just wanted to give folks a heads up on that one. And that's all I have. I don't know if anybody has any questions for me. Okay, we will move along to Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First thing I have is that Sandy Stone, our financial officer, has sent out emails to council members about your financial disclosure forms. They're due in the council office on February 1st. If you have looked at the report from the IG, you note that financial disclosure forms was high on the list of things we in the service need to improve on. So please get your financial disclosure form into Sandy as soon as possible, no later than February 1st. Want to remind you, we sent out, Karen sent you out an email asking if you want to attend the Managing Our Nation's Fisheries Third Conference in Washington, D.C. Please let her know and me know by February 6th so we can plan the budget accordingly, whether you intend to go to that. Terry and Tom will be in Silver Spring, Maryland for an annual CCC meeting, Council Coordinating Committee. We'll be meeting with all the other councils about budget and a number of other items. I've been listening to all our state directors complain about budget cuts they're taking and how busy they are. I don't know why they just don't act like the federal government and don't pass a budget and everything's fine. So But anyway, we're going to talk about budget February 20th and 21st. You have the risk policy workshop March 20th and 21st in Salem. You should be contacting, I think, Pat Fiorelli and in the near future about the risk policy workshop. Long overdue and really needed, and I wish you luck with that one. I want to mention Phil Herring. I've sent you all an email. You know, he got that difficult news that he has stage 4 brain tumor, but you'd never know it. He was in the office. He had the surgery. Everything went extremely well. No side effects from the surgery. He was in the office yesterday. You'd never know he had, you know, 2-3 hours of surgery. His balance, his speech, his sight, no problems. His attitude is absolutely fantastic. He's ready to come back to work. He starts radiation in 2 weeks, followed by chemo 5 days a week for a while, and he expects to be back in the office in May. So he's getting tremendous support from his family, from his friends, from the council staff, has taken his dog and has provided meals for them for a while, and we had a party for him before he went in. He's received all your emails, and he's got his laptop at home, and so make sure you email him and keep him in your thoughts and prayers, but he's doing fantastic. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any questions for Paul? Other than where is he going to be come April 1st in some tropical paradise? Next is Regional Administrator, John.
Thank you. The person sitting to my right is not George Darcy. This is Mike Pentney. George is sick. He's got a contagious virus. This is the first meeting I think he's missed in 30 years. He wanted to be here. I said on your behalf, seeing as he's contagious, we wished him well staying at home. But he is disappointed not to be here, and Mike and others will fill in supporting your still wet behind the ears regional administrator. I'm going to give the regional administrator's report, and I'm actually going to give kind of two reports. One is the normal regional administrator's statement of activities, and then there's a letter concerning some email traffic, a request I'm making of you. We're going to pass out a letter that I've written to Paul that makes a request of you that I'll cover after the normal statement of activities. Okay? So regarding multi-species, on December 5th, we announced to all eligible Northeast multi-species permit holders that sectors have until March 29th of this year to submit their fishing year 2013 rosters to us. We've received approximately 40 sector exemption requests for fishing year 2013. Some of them have been previously approved and some are new. We're currently examining each exemption request and plan to have a proposed rule published in February. Regarding the targeted redfish fishery, a proposed rule to implement a targeted Acadian redfish fishery for sector vessel was published on November 8, 2012. This rule would expand on a previously approved sector exemption by allowing groundfish sector trawl vessels to harvest redfish using nets with cod end mesh as small as 4.5 inches. Due to the need to correct and clarify a measure in the proposed rule, a correction was made in the Federal Register allowing public comment through January 22nd. We plan to have a final rule published in February. regarding ATSI monitoring funding. This comes under the good news part of the program, something that we'll have a lot of, I'm sure, before this meeting concludes on Thursday. Please pay attention here. The regulations currently call for industry to pay for ATSI monitoring to the extent not funded by NOAA fisheries. So the regulations currently call for industry to pay for ATSI monitoring to the extent not funded by NOAA fisheries. A proposed measure in the Council's Framework 48 specifying a coverage level that NIMS can pay for is not likely to be approved. In 2012, NOAA paid the full cost of ATSI monitoring. Our hope is to offset 50% of the cost in 2013. 50% of the cost in 2013. The on-the-water cost of ATSI monitoring is roughly $500 per day. We hope to cover 50% of that, roughly $250 per day. Regardless of whether we are able to pay for 50% of the ATSI monitoring cost, we do plan to continue to pay the off-the-water overhead costs, also roughly $500 per day. And Bill may want to comment more on this in his portion of the program. In the event that we have funds to pay a portion of the coverage, we are working on a mechanism for industry to pay their portion of the cost. And this isn't figured out yet, and it isn't easy. We're not yet sure of the details, but we want to let you and the industry know what to expect so you can plan for these costs. The federal budget and appropriations remain unknown at this time. If the appropriations come in lower, then industry would have to pay more than 50% of the cost. We'll make sure the industry funding mechanism is flexible enough to accommodate whatever money becomes available. As I said, this is important and difficult news on top of everything else we're going to go over, especially tomorrow. Regarding small mesh, on January 15th, we approved Amendment 19, and we intend to have a final rule effective by May 1st. Regarding monkfish, you, the Council, requested that we implement an emergency action that would eliminate monkfish possession limits. We're currently considering that request and may implement emergency measures for the start of the 2013 fishing year on May 1st. Regarding paralytic shellfish poisoning closed area, we published an interim final rule in the Federal Register on December 18th, announcing the reopening of a portion of Georgia's Bank PSP closed area to the harvest of Atlantic surf clam and ocean quahogs. Provided vessels use the approved testing protocol, the interim final rule became effective on January 1st, and the comment period ends February 19th. The reopening is at the request of the Mid-Atlantic Council and based upon the current recent adoption of the protocol to the National Shellfish Sanitation Program by the Interstate Shellfish Sanitation Conference. Regarding SBRM, we are continuing development of the new SBRM omnibus amendment. The draft amendment document has been delayed, but will be ready for the April Council meeting. Regarding protected resources, the coastal Gulf of Maine closure area, we'd like to remind all sink gillnet fishermen that the coastal Gulf of Maine closure area will be in effect beginning February 1st through March 31st. This closure area will go back to October and November beginning 2013. Unless action is taken by NOAA Fisheries in consultation with the Harbor Porpoise Take Reduction Team. There will be a meeting of the Harbor Porpoise Take Reduction Team this February 13th and 14th. Due to budget constraints, this meeting's going to be a webinar. For more information on the meeting, consult our website. That's the highlights of our report. Any questions? If not, then has that letter been passed around? Yes. Oh, sorry. Did someone have a question? Yes. Gary.
I'm wondering what we can do to fix the amount of money that we have for John. I mean, you've seen the
numbers. Observers.
There's no way the industry can afford to pay for that. I mean,
yeah.
And it's ludicrous for us to think that they're going to. They're not going to. There's no way they can afford to pay for it. Fuel is costing $2,000 a day on a lot of these boats, $3,000 a day. There's no possible way they can afford to do it. And we need to fix this, and we need to fix it now, not because this is just another way to with the allocations we have next year, I mean, it's done. It's done.
I couldn't agree more with you, Terry. Could not agree more. I talked yesterday with Harry Mears about priorities, if Congress is fortunate enough to secure disaster funding, I said observer coverage would have to be easily the top priority. And in a discussion I had with Congressman Tierney when he called me on Friday, I said I congratulated him on the persistence that he and other members of Congress have shown in pursuing disaster funding. I said, you guys have had Plan A, Plan B, Plan C, Plan D. They are not deterred in that. We have, as you know, picked up the costs year after year after year. So we certainly recognize the hardship that those costs represent on the industry. So I agree with you. Our budgets are being cut as the industries are. And our commitment is to continue to cover the onshore costs 100%, to cover 50%, and we're going to continue to try and identify resources to push for them from Congress. We need to have monitoring, and we know it represents a burden on industry, and so we'll continue to see if we can argue for resources. Yes, Dave.
Yeah, I sent you all a letter on a way to perhaps fix this problem, not knowing the problem was going to occur on the money end of it, but just a different way of doing business with the Observer program. And it seems to me that that might play in nicely here to a discussion of how we could move forward by changing it from an at-sea program to an onshore program. I think it would reduce the cost by substantially. So I can't seem to find it in a binder. I'm going to check with the secretaries. But I would like to have – I was planning to ask for some discussion of that underground fish, and I think now more than ever we've got to have that discussion.
You want to respond? Yeah. Can Bill respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, we've taken a first look at the letter, and I agree that there are some good ideas there. And some of them are consistent with thinking that we've been having with regards to how to shift the whole process and change the relative responsibilities of the industry and the agency with regards to this whole issue of monitoring and properly documenting both catch and discard. I agree that we need to focus on this some, and I think we can have some preliminary discussion this week, but it's going to take some time for us at the center in the region, I think, to sit down and work through this and provide some more comprehensive feedback. And I agree it's something we need to do soon. that we're in the early days of looking analytically at this idea.
Okay, that's fine. I just want to. I'm going to ask the secretaries to get us a copy so all the members will have it. We need to do this, and now we need to do it. I mean, I said in a letter before May 1st, and that wasn't anticipating that we were paying for half the observers. That was just anticipating the situation with the assumed discard rate. And the fact that for some of us, the assumed discard rate will prevent us from ever untying the lines because we'll never be able, with the transition rate, will keep us from being able to fish, and we'll never be able to change the transition rate because we'll be out of fish on day one. So I'll make sure that gets handed out, and maybe, it can be something to task the groundfish committee to dealing with it at its next meeting or something.
Yeah, Terry.
So maybe this is a question for Bill. I don't know. Is it okay to ask him a question? Is it okay if I ask Bill a question?
Absolutely. I'm sorry. I was just looking to see if the letter was in the package.
So knowing the budget constraints that we're under and everything, the pilot program that we have going on now with electronic monitoring, is there any way to fast track that in order to decrease the price of monitoring for this fishing year? I mean, the pilot program's been going on long enough, so we ought to have a little bit of information there. And is there any way to fast-track that? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out ways to cut the cost of these observers or something.
Mr. Chairman, this is a very important question, and the agency has been looking from a policy point of view on how best to move forward with EM, and we've been deliberating over this between the center and the region. And I think that we have to focus the discussion on the types of things that we think collectively we can achieve in the shorter term. And I think that one idea that we really need to work on is one that really does focus on shoreside accounting using EM for monitoring for compliance with retention requirements. And another one has to do with how we change the way we're thinking to shift the burden of proof so that we can depend on industry reports and then verify using electronic monitoring and other tools that are available to us. The real challenge is how we can accelerate the thinking in a way that we can bring something on board sooner rather than later. And that is challenging for us, but it's certainly something that we need to get our teeth into, John, and figure out if there's some way we can do that.
I'm sure you know, Archipelago, the one that I've actually seen in action, I mean, in Vancouver, that's been an accepted way that they do that up there for how many years? I mean, 15 years? Is that so? I mean, there is some evidence that it works, and I'm just grasping at straws here. So,
yeah, if I can respond, I'm familiar with Archipelago, with their work. I've been up to visit them, and I've worked with them on some projects on the West Coast and in Alaska. I think that concept holds promise. The the challenge, again, is that it's been designed to fit into the regulatory and statutory framework that works in British Columbia. So the challenge is for us, and we have to accept that challenge, to figure out how to make something like that work in this environment.
Dave, the letter is in the package. At least it's on my disk. It's in under Groundfish Correspondence 6A, and it's the second letter in that package.
Okay, Tom, and the paper ones, I don't have a 6A. I just got a 6. That's probably why.
Tom Dempsey, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that point, recently, actually NOAA, in a week or two ago, came back in the Alaska halibut fishery and looking at the same issues, the same costs, operational costs of at-sea monitoring, and looking at electronic monitoring as a potential tool, said, we see this as a problem, we see this as a potential solution, but don't expect us to approve it within 2 years. 2 years, as I think Terry highlighted and others have, is way too long. In 2 years, a solution in 2 years is not going to cut it. So given that NOAA has come out publicly and said that electronic monitoring, at least in that fishery, is at least 2 years away, what would you say in terms of the timeline here in New England? From my standpoint, we've been very slow in this process, and I think we can all agree that that's where we want to get. But 2 to 3 years, I think, is unacceptably too long a timeline.
Chairman, I agree. I agree that we have to figure out a way, excuse me, to move forward as rapidly and in as deliberative a way as possible. I cannot tell you at this point. I cannot give you a time and a date at this point. All I can say is that for the last couple of months, and certainly in the foreseeable future, we are going to be working on this, and we are going to be looking for some solutions. Again, I think there's some major process-related challenges, but I don't believe that there are insurmountable challenges. I believe that we can figure out ways to solve these problems, and I think we have to be responsive to these needs. They're real, and I think that the solution, the problems, can be solved. So we will work on it, and we will keep people informed.
Terry?
So are they regulatory things that we can help change, or do we need congressional people to try to help change this? Or, you said process. I'm just wondering how we can help you make the changes that we need to get this done.
This is really, Mr. Chairman, a shared issue for the regional office and the center, because we at the center, of course, are responsible for the technical aspects and the logistic aspects. But in terms of the regulatory requirements, I have to defer to John's staff on that.
I think the answer is probably all three, because I think that... I'm the last person you want to talk to about anything that has the word electronic in it. But I think pretty clearly there's a regulatory aspect, so the council's going to have to get involved. There's a congressional element to this. When I was more optimistic about disaster funding, I thought there might be a slug of money, because all the congressional staffers I talked to felt that this was clearly the highest priority. And I thought we might have some money to invest in electronic monitoring that would be the kind of surge that would get us over the hump in electronic monitoring, so we could shorten the time period that Tom referred to, and that Bill both said was unacceptable. It would be the one-time investment that would get us along. But now that seems, you know, that seems like the less likely to happen. And without that, I don't know where that money comes from. So there is a congressional role to play, but the degree of difficulty is harder. So I think there is a congressional role, there is a council role, and there's a role for the regional office and the science center in figuring out how do you mesh the fishery management plan and the technology, and where do you get the money? How do you put them all together?
Bill?
Paul Howard mentioned, I think, in his report, that the council chairs meeting is coming up later in February in Washington, D.C. And I know John will be there and I will be there. And I know that this issue of electronic monitoring is on the agenda. So we will have some opportunity to follow up with the leadership and perhaps have the right people in the room to be able to identify what the impediments are and start to work on resolving them.
Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly what I was going to mention, is that recently RIP and I have been contacted about having a national workshop on EM, electronic monitoring. Basically, for what Tom had mentioned, this is a national issue. We need a national policy, and the councils, Silver Spring, and the regions need to, and the science centers, need to come together with a national workshop to set some national policy with funding. So it's not going to be as timely as we'd like, but it is a national concern, and we will be discussing a national workshop in next month.
Anyone else on this subject? John, you had.
So I want to read a letter that has been handed out that concerns some email traffic. I want to preface by the request I'm going to make is not as onerous as it may seem at the beginning, but it is important. And so it's a short letter, so I'm just going to read it because it goes over some older history. This will refresh all our minds. And I wanted, rather than send this out where you might be reading this in your kitchen and going berserk, to have it in front of you so you can ask me questions and consigliere over there so we can get this all done rather quickly. On February 3rd, 2012, Attorney Paul Muniz filed a Freedom of Information request with NOAA asking for the following records: any and all emails between Vito Giacalone of Gloucester and any member of the New England Fishery Management Council dated after January 1st, 2008. In response to this request, NIMS tasked five offices within the Northeast region, including staff at the council, to search for email records containing Vito Giacalone's name in the to, from, CC, or BCC fields. NIMS did not request that council members themselves, that is you, conduct a search for their email accounts or files for responsive records. NIMS search yielded 13 emails between Mr. Giacalone and council members, which comprised 22 printed pages. On May 7, 2012, NIMS provided these records to Mr. Muniz. On June 6, 2012, Mr. Muniz filed an administrative appeal to DOC's Office of General Counsel for Administration. Mr. Muniz asserted that NIMS failed to conduct an adequate search because it failed to ask each council member to conduct a search for responsive documents. The Federal Records Act requires agencies to, quote, preserve records containing adequate and proper documentation of the organization, function, policies, decision, procedures, and essential transactions of the agents. Documents written or received by council members are agency records that are subject to the Federal Records Act and to FOIA if they reflect official council business. For purposes of the FOIA request in question, a document reflects council business if it relates to a matter within the council's jurisdiction and the document is specifically discussed or disseminated at a council meeting, including a committee meeting, planning meetings, etc. Official council business does not include emails that reflect personal or private business matters or matters related to other employment. In this particular case, there's some question whether all documents disseminated or specifically discussed at council meetings have been properly collected and maintained for records retention purposes. Therefore, the Office of General Counsel Administration has requested that council members conduct a search of their email accounts and files for emails with Vito Giacalone that reflect council business as described above. NIMS, in conjunction with the Office of General Counsel and NOAA General Counsel, will review any records that council members produce and determine whether they are responsive to the request, and if they are, whether they are subject to disclosure under the FOIA. Though some responsive records may be released, any personal identifiers on the emails, such as the email address of the council member will be withheld. Please share this letter with all current council members. We need each member to search his or her email accounts and files for responsive emails between the member and Vito Giacalone dated between January 1, 2008 and February 6, 2012. Copies of any such emails should be sent to me at the address above by close of business on February 11th, 2013, so we can determine if any of these emails must be released in accordance with the FOIA. We appreciate the cooperation of the council members in meeting our legal obligation under the FOIA. So this is what we're asking of you to do by February 11th, is search your emails, and if you have emails, to send them to me by February 11th. Now, to summarize, those emails, you have to check off kind of two boxes. One, it has to be an email between you and Vito Giacalone, and secondly, it has to have been referred to specifically in a council meeting, right? So if you had an email between you and Vito Giacalone, but that email wasn't referred to specifically in a council meeting, that doesn't count. You have to check off both those boxes. So it's quite conceivable you don't have any such emails where you're checking off both those boxes, all right? So please search through your records, and if you have any emails where it's both an email between you and Vito and that specific email was referred to specifically in a council meeting, then send that email to me. Now, question. Oh, I had such an email in an old computer which crashed and burned, and it's in a garbage can. I can't find that email. Well, you can't find the email, you can't find the email. Or I deleted all those emails in 2008 a long time ago. You can't find the email, you can't find the email, all right? You search. If you can find it and you can check off both those boxes, send that email to me, all right? General question. Is this going to apply just to us? This is a pain in the neck. Yes, it is a pain in the neck. It makes being a council member more difficult than it already is. And Gene went through a briefing, two or three meetings ago, of conflict. This is going to apply to all councils. This is just also in response to a specific FOIA request that puts it on our table right now. But this guidance is going to be generalized and is going to apply to all councils. And we are going to develop more guidance that will apply to all councils. So we will try and make sure that we give guidance that makes this easier, not just for the New England Council, but for all councils, to handle this. Things like council email addresses and things like that may make this easier to do in the future. So we will try and make this job easier. The inherent conflict of you are a citizen and you are also a council member is inherent in Magnuson. It's inherent in the council. We don't want to get rid of that. That's the beauty of the council. But there is this separation that we're going to have to deal with. So questions. Laura, you had a question.
I was just wondering who the lawyer was bringing the suit on behalf of, or the request on behalf of. Who's Mr. Mooney's working for? On behalf of.
Gene, do you want to answer that?
I don't know who he's working. He represented the Gloucester auction during a lot of the conflict there. I'm not sure who he's asking. That might have been in the request, but I don't know off the top of my head. I don't think it was, but it could have been.
I'd also point out we resisted this incursion to DOC as much as we could, because we thought this was an incursion in but we lost that battle. So that's why we're coming back to you. Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, I'm trying to
trying to just understand what I got to look for. Most documents go to the council. I mean, I send a letter to the council. It gets a stamp, received such and such a date. You've got all those, right? I assume. So you're looking for documents where somebody sent an email to an individual council member and then had to say in it, you know, RE, the Groundfish Committee meeting last week or something like that, you know, I'd like to discuss further on an individual basis. Is that it? I just want to know what I'm looking for. I am a little confused here as to, you know, what the criteria is that it has to be turned over.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Gene, but this is an email that would be between you and Mr. Giacalone. So either you're writing him or he's writing you. And number one, and it is an email that is specifically referred to in a council meeting. So either he wrote you or you wrote him. Is that correct, Gene?
Yeah, and just to clarify, it's not just emails. It's any document, if a document was handed to you, for example. But I think the focus is, first, is not so much on the subject matter of the email, as long as it's within the council's jurisdiction. It's rather, was it, for instance, a hypothetical, if you got an email from Mr. Giacalone and he made some reference to impacts on fishing industry members that he represents, and then you brought that up at a council meeting referring to this document at the council meeting, then that's the document that might be considered a council business record. Just because you got an email or a document that referred to something that might be of interest to the council, but you never brought it up at the council meeting or referred to it, then that document would not fall under the guidelines in this letter.
Okay, that helps quite a bit, because what I'm trying to determine is, as an example, I'm a member of the Seafood Coalition. You know, I was on the board of directors at the time. We write each other as the board of directors all the time about issues related to groundfish, but they're board of directors issues. They're not groundfish. They're not brought up at a council meeting. They're for you know, how the board of directors is going to create a policy or something. So if it's only something that was actually brought up at a groundfish committee meeting or... I mean, groundfish or the full council, those are the only two things I could think that he'd have an interaction with. That narrows it up quite a bit, makes it a little easier to at least figure out what I'm looking for. Thank you.
Paul, you had a question?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chairman. John, I think in the past when we get legal determinations, it's done from Washington and it becomes a national policy that all the councils follow, and you mentioned that. My concern is this a local interpretation of the FOI that will have to be presented to NOAA General Counsel to be disseminated and talked about nationally, or is this a national policy to be presented nationally? And that makes a difference in my mind. Whether we're doing this guidance locally or if it's coming nationally.
I'm not sure I understand the question. My guess is that this is a local precedent that's going to have national implications. But
no, the determination under FOIA that what council business is, That's new. For the purpose of FOIA request and question, a document reflects council business. That paragraph is new policy. That has not been written anywhere before. So my question is, is that a local interpretation that has to be further developed nationally for other councils to adhere to, or is this a local interpretation that our council might not be very happy with?
Gene, do you want to...
It's the former. This policy was sort of developed in response to the specific appeal of this FOIA, where the Office of General Counsel at Commerce has decided what what qualifies as an official business record of the council. So it immediately applies to this council, but my understanding is it will be a national policy so that all councils will be informed, and probably at this next meeting, that as of now, official council business includes the types of documents, emails, et cetera, that are described in here. You know, the specific most relevant language in this letter is in the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph down, you know, for council members, where the middle of the paragraph, it starts out for purposes of the FOIA request. That lays out the specific requirements that were just described about a document being specifically specifically discussed, which implies referred to and discussed, and disseminated at a council meeting.
Gene, if I could just follow up on that. Do you consider this to be a change in policy or a clarification of what we had discussed earlier?
I think it's more, I don't know if the specific question was ever asked directly. So in that case, you could argue it's a clarification. We do have regs on the books now that describes what we consider to be records under federal control, which do not specifically describe this instance. So it may be a rhetorical difference. I think it can be called a clarification that was just never fully appreciated by councils, by this council, and probably by other councils.
Mark?
Well, a little clarification here. I just did a quick search, and I have many emails in which myself and Mr. Giacalone were both CC'd. Those are out of bounds from this, right? Because they weren't between him and me.
If that email was presented to the council, so they've seen that email, or you have discussed that email, that you received it and it asked for this, or you discussed it, then it's part of the FOIA. But if you just got it and you never mentioned it at a committee meeting that you got this email, if you've never referred to it, or if it's never been copied for the council, it's off the table.
Tom Dempsey.
I guess I have to respectfully disagree with Gene on this. I think this is more than a rhetorical change. I think we've all been through council training, or many of us have at least, and I was never made aware that I was within the bounds of a FOIA. I mean, explicitly made aware that I was not. That's more than a rhetorical change or a clarification. I don't think I have any emails, but it's 4 years. I'm glad that we were presented this letter at the table so we weren't all in our kitchens blowing up, but I have to say, this is more than a small change. This is significant, and I think this is not what I was led to believe in terms of our communications and our private business or anything else. This is different, and I'm not sure I'm entirely comfortable with this decision. And I'm just wrapping my head now around what it actually means, but this is a significant jumping off from what I was trained and the three of us here were informed of only a year ago. So I have to express some real disappointment and frustration with where we are.
Gene?
Yeah, just to clarify, I wasn't saying it was a rhetorical change. I was saying whether you call it a clarification or a change, you know, is a rhetorical maybe a rhetorical difference. I mean, if it makes you more comfortable to call this a change, that's fine. I don't think it really matters. We now know what General Counsel at Commerce intends to be an official council business record. So, and I fully appreciate that council members may not have understood that to be the case, I accept that concern.
Tom?
It's not that I didn't understand it to be the case. It's that I was told it was not the case only a year ago, and this is retroactive to 4 years ago. That's a problem. I mean, it's not like I went out and informed myself about the bounds of FOIA and my role on the council as opposed to my role as a private citizen. It's that I was told that I was not a party to this, you know, to these FOIAs. And now, not only is that not only the change going forward, it's a change going back 4 years. I find that problematic.
Paul.
Just want to reiterate again, Mr. Chairman, that to Mark, that say you got an email or was CC'd on an email, so you got that email, you were copied on it from Vito. If you mentioned at the committee meeting you received an email from Vito or CC and it discusses this, or if you made that available as a document, you copied it and the council got it or the Groundfish Committee got it. So you either have copied that document and the council got it, that's official council business, or if you received an email and you referenced it in a discussion, including Vito Ciccoloni said or this or that, then those are the only two instances. So I don't expect you have very much of that or any of it, but don't go looking for anything more than you specifically mentioned that email or it was copied to the council. That's easy. Then if it was copied for the council, I've already given it as part of the admin record. But if you referred to it, that you received an email and you talked about the substance of it and mentioned Vito Ciccoloni, that's what they want, copies of that email, in my opinion.
No, I wasn't talking about emails that Vito sent that I was CC'd on. I was talking about emails that were sent by someone else that I was CC'd on and he was CC'd on. And that seemed to have been out of bounds from what John stated earlier. So.
Yeah, a lot of hands going up now. Peter Kendall.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I realize this is a change midstream. And this is going to open up a can of worms. I mean, this is Vito. Who's to say someone else isn't going to come with somebody else's name? I mean, there could be a lot of ramifications with switching this or informing us now of what what could possibly people might have to dig back through their emails. So I see this as very problematic.
Terry Alexander.
Well, when we were down there this November for council training, I think the policy had started to move from when Tom was there because we were told that emails were FOIA-able, so that was just a couple months ago. I mean, is that Vinny, Matt, John, is that the way you guys took it? So, I mean, we were told that in November, October.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think going forward, it won't be that hard to comply with this. But going back and saying, do you remember what you discussed at a Groundfish Committee meeting in 2008? I haven't got a clue. And you know, did I mention Vito's name? I'm not sitting here and going through all these transcripts. I'll be there, you know, long after I'm a council member. And so, I mean, you know, as an example, I'd be happy. You want to send Gene or Mitch over and they can look at my computer and read all the emails? If that makes everybody happy, knock yourself out. But, I don't know. There's no possible way of complying with this because I don't remember what was said 4 years ago because nobody told me I was going to have to remember it in 2013. Actually, it's 5 years ago. So, I don't know. Maybe we need more information or something. I mean, to John's original comment. I mean, I'm lucky. My computer did crash and burn last year, so everything prior to sometime, and I got to call my wife and find out when it was. June, July, August, somewhere in there is gone. But it's still an issue going forward here that 5 years from now somebody might pop out of the blue and go, oh, by the way, we want to see all your records from when you were a council member. And it's one of the things I will need to know going forward is how long do I have to preserve this junk? I mean, most of the time I just hit delete when I'm done with it. But I want to know, you know, have I got to specifically now keep any email that any person sends me and references the word New England Fisheries Management Council in it for, you know, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, what, you know. So there are a lot of embedded questions in this, and it certainly is a surprise.
Gene, do you think that there is any change in policy as to how we have to maintain email records, or whether, in fact, we could routinely just be deleting everything?
NIMS is developing guidance on this. I can't. I mean, that's a possibility that will be forthcoming. You know, I have to emphasize, from the NOAA NIMS perspective, we fought this. We didn't make the final decision. That rests with Office of General Counsel at Commerce that has the final say on appeals and ultimately what is considered to be a FOIA-able document or not. I guess my advice in the meantime is not to delete these records, and just to avoid any potential conflict until you get further guidance on how this should be handled. So that's the best advice I can give to you at this point.
John.
Let me amplify what Gene said. When Bill and I were out in Seattle meeting with all the other center and regional offices with Sam Rauch and Eric Schwab, and this topic came up, I made the point that these kind of decisions, we're going to have a very chilling effect on people's willingness to serve as council members, a job that is already very difficult, because they were going to be an incursion. And that, you know, Sam and Eric, we're going to have to take that information back and fight, as Gene said, that natural tendency by lawyers. I don't mean to be pejorative, but by people who don't think of the impacts of constantly, invading, because it would have the impact of discouraging people from wanting to serve on councils, and that at the least, what was going to have to happen very quickly is training and training manuals were going to have to be developed for council members so that people could know what, you know, answers to very simple questions. You know, what do I do with emails? And how do I deal with, you know, conflict of interest kinds of situations? As I think Gene's training on conflict was the first training that was done for any council. And every council was going to need to get that, both in kind of face-to-face training and handbooks and you know, mechanical things like email accounts. We need to take steps to make things easier, not just harder. So that separation between, okay, Peter, when am I citizen Peter and when am I council member Peter? How can you make it easier for me to keep things straight between citizen Peter and council member Peter, so that I can keep a firewall between those two roles, because you're going to always be citizen Peter, and some of the times you're going to be council member Peter. So I need a firewall between those two things. And so we need to be able to do that. And people need to understand that it is a serious incursion. And the retroactive nature of that incursion needs to be appreciated.
Dave Preble and Doug Grove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Interesting discussion. I think the answer is going to have to be a separate account, specifically for council emails. I don't see any other option here. I can see this coming, that they're going to require that all of these emails, council emails, be preserved. That just goes along with it. And I agree with what Tom said, and Peter in particular. This is offensive. It's deeply offensive. In fact, I'm in the process now of just finishing a rereading of Brave New World, and this is exactly the kind of thing that it talks about. My question is, as we move into the future, how many of these fishing trips are we going to have to endure, and at what point do the fishing trips become harassment to try to reduce the efficiency of council work, to purposely have these fishing trips for that purpose, to reduce the efficiency? Also, as a matter of personal policy, I've for several years now, I just delete emails anyway. I don't even keep emails anymore. But this is a profound change, and I think the only short-term answer is going to be just to have a separate account that all council business comes in on.
Doug Grove. Can't tell whether it's on because the light doesn't go on. So is it on? Okay. Just a clarification, this applies only to current council members, not past council members, correct?
That is correct, and that was a change from first drafts, by the way.
Terry Alexander.
I really think this is going to add a lot of extra time to us council meetings, because I ask a lot of questions during the discussion here to people around the table or whatever, and I'm going to still have to ask those questions in order to vote on issues, and I really think that's going to add a lot of extra time, because we're all going to be asking questions to everybody that we work with all the time, and if we're not allowed to do that without it being I'm just worried that's going to add a lot of extra time to each one of our agenda items.
Tom Dempsey, then Dave Gaisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see this as basically two fundamental different components. One is, as Dave said, what are we going to do from here forward? Different email accounts, different policies, a manual on how we're going to move forward. I have no problem with that, right? That's a rules change. We want to increase accountability, transparency. I'm all for it. But we make a lot of rules here, and we make a lot of policy changes, and we never reach back, right? So if in an FMP we move to weekly reporting, when we implement that rule, we never mandate that the fishery comply retroactively for the last 10 years. You've never had to, fill out a weekly trip report, but we'd really like you to do that for the last decade. So I just fundamentally don't understand, and I have a real problem with changing the rules and pretending that we started with those rules and we all knew how to comply. So while I fully support transparency, moving forward with a manual and new policies, that's a conversation that we can have here. But I actually do think that we need to oppose the reach back. I just don't think that's an appropriate way to change policy. And I think in some ways it's even being applied somewhat arbitrarily. So we're now, because we're at this table, being told to keep all our emails. People who just came off the council less than 12 months ago, they don't have to keep their emails. This doesn't apply to them, but it will apply to us when we come off the council. I think it's very difficult to understand where this line is being drawn, and I think while we can all have a constructive conversation moving forward to increase transparency and compliance, reaching back is a different matter, and I don't agree.
Dave Gaisel.
I'm going to try and use another example here from, we've been talking about fishermen talking to other fishermen, and I talk to every fisherman in this room, on the council, off the council, but I also talk to a lot of other people. So, for example, I talk to Peter Shelley, or I talk to Roger Fleming, their lawyers. And if I say at a groundfish committee meeting, well, Peter Shelley contacted me and said this, apparently now I have to preserve that email and send it to you. But my question is, now, do those people get notified that, you know, by the way, I'm going to be turning over your conversations. I mean, I know lawyers get kind of touchy about privileged conversation. You know, they always put a big disclaimer on the bottom of everything they send you. It's about a half a page long about, you know, you can't disseminate this. You can't, you know, if you get this by mistake, you got to send it back or something. So, you know, is somebody going to call up Peter Shelley and say, oh, by the way, we may be subpoenaing all your emails?
John, do you have any more good news for us?
Mercifully, that concludes my report.
John Quinn, do you have a...
Yeah, I guess I'll add my two cents here. I couldn't agree more with Tom Dempsey that it's... prospective is one thing, but that retroactivity, the whole concept of having notice that that's going to be the rule, I think, is very troubling. And I also want to support what David Gaethel said, is that this two-step process of does the document exist is one thing, but saying that, did you then use it in a meeting? And I don't want to quibble with the definition of a document under the Federal Records Act, but I think it's awful difficult to say, you know, they can ask for the document, but did you use it, I think, is something that is virtually impossible. I don't know what I said last week, never mind what I said in 2008 at a meeting.
Howard.
Yes, thank you. John, the interim rule for surf clam ocean quahog was published after the MIDS count December meeting. And our next meeting is middle of February, and I think it's going to be an issue for the council. So my question is, what's the administrative timeline for further action on that interim rule?
Can you repeat that, Howard?
Sure. Your interim rule for the surf clam, ocean quahog, was published after the Mid-Atlantic Council December meeting. We don't meet again until the middle of February. And I think it's going to be an issue for the council. My question is, what's the administrative timeline for further action on the interim rule?
So one of the reasons we published this as an interim final rule, not only was to take additional comment because the New England Council had specifically requested that we, taking a step back, when we published the proposed rule for to reopen the area, as the comment period was closing on the proposed rule, the New England Council specifically requested that we extend the comment period for 60 days to facilitate the New England Council's discussing and preparing comments on that rule. We entertained that, but we're concerned that if we did extend the comment period on the proposed rule for the full 60 days as requested, we would not be able to implement the final rule by January 1st, as had been requested by both the industry and Mid-Atlantic Council. So the compromise solution was to implement an interim final rule, which allowed us to have the opening effective January 1st, but also provide an additional 60 days for comments on the action to enable the New England Council, if it still desired, to provide comments on our proposed action. Moving forward, there is no required resolution to an interim final rule. In other words, it will stay effective as an interim rule until such time that we publish a final rule, which we have no specific plans to at this time. One of the things that we discussed is one of the comments by New England Council was that it was currently engaged in development of its EFH omnibus amendment that may reconfigure some of the groundfished and habitat closed areas. And there was some concern expressed by the New England Council that an action undertaken as requested by the Mid-Atlantic Council to reopen this area could undermine some of the potential habitat closed areas that may be considered as part of the EFH amendment by the New England Council. So our current plan basically is to allow the New England Council's process to play out to see what, if any, new habitat closed areas are proposed and eventually implemented through that process. And then once we know what changes come through for that process, we will then be able to see if any changes are necessary to the area that has been reopened for clams, and then publish any changes to that as a final rule.
Yeah, thank you. That was a very thorough answer. Well, this may come up Thursday then under the Habitat Committee. Thank you.
Dave Gatel, and then we're going to move on.
Just one quick last bite at the apple. Since we're going to have to, this is doing council business to search these emails. Are we going to be compensated for our time?
No.
Move on to NOAA general comment.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's a legitimate question we'll ask as to whether, I don't know if it's up to the executive director or if it would be NIMP's policy, because it is a legitimate question, I think. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I did not get a chance to brief the council on the appellate court decision in the challenge to Amendment 16 by a number of industry groups and others. That happened between the November meeting and the December meeting. In the December meeting, we didn't conduct this portion of the normal agenda for the council. So I'm going to just very briefly summarize the decision and the appellate court decision that upheld Amendment 16 and all of the challenges thereto. The court organizes their decision into three major categories of decisions that were included in their opinion. The first is whether the Amendment 16 sector program was a LAP, a limited access program, privilege program, or an IFQ, individual fishing quota, or both under the Madison-Stevens Act. And as a result, whether if it was or wasn't, whether the agency implemented Amendment 16 within the requirements prescribed for LAPs and IFQs. The second general issue was whether Amendment 16 complied with Madison Act national standards, in particular National Standard 1, national standard involving ending overfishing and rebuilding fish programs, rebuilding fisheries, and National Standard 8, which requires minimization of impacts on fishing communities to the extent practicable within the conservation objectives of an FMP. And the third general category was whether Amendment 16 was implemented consistent with National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, particularly with respect to whether it discussed reasonable alternatives under the best information available concerning this management measures that were adopted in Amendment 16. As to the first category, the court emphatically found that NIMPS had reasonably interpreted the Madison-Stevens Act to find that sectors were not an IFQ or an LAPP and therefore were not required to go through a referendum first, nor did Amendment 16 have to adopt measures under the limited access privilege program, such as requirement to collect administrative fees up to 3% from fishing vessels. Under the second category concerning consistency with national standards, the court looked at a couple of provisions, as I said here. One was it appropriate for Amendment 16 to manage on a stock-by-stock basis as opposed to a fishery basis or a mixed-stock fishery kind of basis? And the court found that that was consistent with the national standards and other provisions of the Madison-Stevens Act. The court also found that the agency did an adequate or did legally acceptable analysis of impacts on fishing communities, on fairness and equity concerns under National Standard 4, that there is an overarching restriction on what a council or the agency can do to minimize impacts on fishing communities, which is the conservation requirements under National Standard 1 to end overfishing and rebuild fisheries. So stating that another way, minimization of impacts can only go so far as they do not trump conservation objectives of ending overfishing and rebuilding fisheries. And finally, the court found that Amendment 16 was consistent with NEPA standards, that there were a reasonable range of alternatives discussed with respect to the sector, augmentation of the sector program, and that there was adequate analysis of socioeconomic impacts of the amendment given the information that was available to the agency. And one other thing with respect to the first category concerning whether sectors were lapsed in IFQs, the court found that, you know, regardless of the answer to that question, there was a specific exemption from the requirement to do a referendum if it involved sector allocations, and the court found that the Amendment 16 change to the sector program did fall under that exemption. So that, as far as I know, there has been no appeal or a request for a writ of certiorari of the Supreme Court, and therefore this should be the final decision with respect to this lawsuit. The other news or other update I wanted to give you in connection with the challenge by Oceana to the approval of the sector operations plan in 2012 is that the government and the plaintiff have reached, have signed a settlement agreement, which basically takes off the table justifying the level of at-sea monitoring that the agency found was necessary for 2012 in exchange for an agreement by the agency to publish and make available on a website its analysis for what the level of ASM monitoring shall be for 2013 through 2015. This is essentially agreeing to something that we're already required to do, except we're making it transparent, more transparent, by including the analysis as to what level is necessary in a summary that will be available on the NIMS website. This settlement agreement has not yet been adopted by the court. I think the plan is to submit it today or tomorrow to the court, but that should be a formality. That's the only two lawsuits I wanted to update the council on. Mitch is going to update you on the challenge to the Mid-Atlantic's omnibus amendment that established ACLAM's Amendment 4, sorry. This is the, I got the wrong lawsuit. This is the Amendment 4 Herring lawsuit. You're not going to give an update on the council, on the other one. Sorry.
Thank you. This is mostly a procedural update to the case involving the challenge to Amendment 4 to the Herring Fishery Management Plan. As you may recall, the case was Flaherty versus Locke at one point. Now it's Flaherty versus Blank, and they challenged the Fishery Management Plan's omission of river herring in the fishery's definition of stocks in the fishery. They also challenged whether the Fishery Management Plan minimized bycatch to the extent practicable, or whether the agency determined whether it complied with the Magnuson Act's National Standard 9 requirement that it do so, and then also whether the agency took a hard look at reasonable range of alternatives in its NEPA analysis, particularly concerning the ABC control rule and accountability measures. So the agency in response, the court issued a remedial order in August, and it required the National Marine Fisheries Service to consider whether the whether Amendment 4's definition of stocks in the fishery complied with the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and to file with the court a supplemental explanation of its consideration within 1 month of the August 2nd remedial order. NIMS filed its supplemental explanation on August 31st, 2012. The court also ordered NIMS to send a letter to the council within 1 month of the remedial order explaining the applicable law and National Standard 1 guidelines relating to determining the stocks to be included in a fishery, and recommending that the council consider whether river herring and shad should be designated as stocks in the fishery for the Atlantic Fishery Management Plan. NIMS did send that letter to the council on August 31st, recommending the council consider this issue in an amendment to the Atlantic Herring FMP. In addition, the National Marine Fisheries Service is required to provide a status update to the court, and that is due this Friday. And we will be filing that status update that will also discuss some of the issues being considered by the council for the specifications process. And also, coming up within a year's time period, National Marine Fisheries Service is going to be required to provide a completed NEPA analysis for the 2013 and 15 specifications and also file with the court an explanation setting forth its consideration of whether the Atlantic herring FMP minimizes bycatch to the extent practicable and report on all remedial actions taken in response to the court's order.
Are there any questions of Gene or Mitch? Thank you. We'll move on to the Science Center. Dr. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll ask Jim, Dr. Weinberg, to start us off, and then I'll follow up on a couple of issues.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll give an update on some survey activities and stock assessments and upcoming meetings. The ecosystems monitoring and small pelagics cruise will take place within this February on the FSV Pisces in order to collect and process data related to the distribution of small pelagic forage fish, such as herring and mackerel. There will be a technical cruise with the Bigelow in February to do some gear testing related to the multi-beam sonar and the autotrawl system. And this is not a fish survey, but work on gear technology. The spring multi-species bottom trawl survey is scheduled on the Bigelow beginning on March the 4th of this year. For stock assessments, the SARC 55 peer review took place the first week in December of 2012 with Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod, and I will be reporting on that tomorrow morning, giving a summary of the results as well as some of the highlights of what the peer review panel concluded. Upcoming assessments include SARC 56 with white hake and Atlantic surf clam. And the dates for that meeting are February the 19th through the 22nd. There will be another SARC this summer, SARC 57, with striped bass and summer flounder during the week of July the 22nd. There is also going to be an Eastern Georges Bank cod benchmark assessment through the track process sometime in April in St. Andrews, Canada. In June, there will be the updates through the track process of the shared stocks Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail. The center will also be conducting a number of stock assessment updates throughout the spring, summer, and fall. These include bluefish, black sea bass, scup, dogfish, skates, monkfish, and ocean quahogs, mackerel, and butterfish. And the dates for that monkfish review will be March the 27th through the 28th. Then in the fall and getting into winter, SARC 58 is scheduled for northern shrimp, tilefish, and butterfish. As some of you may know, the center has proposed that a review be done of the methods that are used to collect data for the scallop assessment. And progress has been made on reaching out to all of the partners who will be involved in providing data and participating in the peer review. And terms of reference for the review have been set. The dates for the peer review have not been established yet, and it, we're in the process of trying to find a time when all of the parties are free. But it's likely to occur sometime around April. And one last thing that I'd like to mention, and this has to do with the HABCAM that was used during the last SCALLOP survey, and it's a very high-resolution camera that was used to take photographs of the ocean floor and survey scallops. Well, it not only takes pictures in high resolution of scallops, but it also does excellent high-resolution mapping of the seafloor, and it sees fish and invertebrates and bottom habitat types. So in a collaboration between the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, SMAST, the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, and the HABCAM group, they've recently initiated a project to estimate fish abundance. And this is just getting started, and there have been one or two meetings to basically start looking at the images and trying to identify and calculate fish abundances. Now, it's too early to have any data to talk about, and there are a lot of things to work out in order to take these images and actually have raw counts and translate them into population estimates. But the hope among all the parties involved is that this sort of collaboration can eventually go forward so that it'll take full, better worth of the HABCAM with all of the technology that it has, and not just provide information about scallops, but also a lot of other things. And the expectation of the group is that they will have a report that will be available for review through the TRAC process this June. That completes my report, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Karp.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Weinberg. Mr. Chairman, shall I proceed at this point, or do you? Okay. I wanted to follow up on some survey-related issues and also on some review-related activities. First of all, surveys. We have spoken from time to time about the center's interest and the agency's interest in working with the industry and other interested parties on a potential industry vessel-based flatfish survey. And we have begun within the center to develop talking points with the intent of convening a meeting with industry in the near future to figure out on exactly what the next steps are and to build a shared perspective on how we might proceed with this. At the same time, I've been in conversation with Dr. Brian Rothschild and others at SMAST about similar ideas for working with the industry for looking at questions related to survey performance, gear performance, and those kinds of things. And next week, SMAST is holding a meeting which some of our scientists will attend to begin some discussions along those lines. So our intent really is to work collaboratively with SMAST and with the industry in looking at both short-term questions relative to survey gear performance and longer-term challenges relative to the potential for developing an industry-based survey. And even though this is in the early stages, I want everyone to know what is going on here, and we will keep you apprised of progress in that direction. Also, I've spoken from time to time about the reviews that are taking place within all of the fisheries science centers of stock assessment methodology, and that these will be synchronized and a sort of stepwise approach. So this year, each of the science centers is going to be looking at the data sources that support stock assessment. That's fishery-dependent data and fishery independent, which is survey data. And we're working to develop plans to carry out a review within the Science Center, which will probably be in August of this year. Also, we've been in conversation with SMAST and MFI relative to some ideas that they've put on the table for review activities which will complement the work that we're doing within the agency. And several of you around the table here, I think, attended a scoping meeting just before Christmas, which was intended to look at ideas that could be developed in a way that, again, synchronized with the agency effort and would bring a broader perspective as well as a focus on some of the challenges we're facing in New England. And last week, MFI published the report from that meeting and also a short summary which focused on the plans to carry out three workshops in the relatively near future to focus on specific aspects of the stock assessment process. And those, in a nutshell, are survey-related issues, survey and data-related issues, shall I say, questions about how best to proceed with a methodology that can recognize environmental signals in the stock assessment, which is part of moving towards the ecosystem approach. And also the third one would focus on reference points and approaches, analytical approaches to addressing questions about reference points and improved criteria perhaps for selection of reference points. I've signaled back to MFI and SMAS the center's support for these activities and our desire to work closely with them on developing the agendas and on plans for carrying out these workshops. And I believe, again, that we've moved towards a position where we're working together on activities which will complement each other to focus on some of the challenges which we are facing relative to the assessments of groundfish in this region. So while none of these activities are going to bring immediate answers to some of the questions which I know we're going to be discussing tomorrow, I think they do open up some opportunities for us to bring a depth and breadth of scientific perspective to help us move forward to address some of these challenges. So I'm very pleased that we're moving in that direction. Along those lines also, the agency is supporting a new faculty position at SMAST, which will be in the area of stock assessment or ecosystem-related science. And I know that the search committee for that position has been established. One of our scientists is sitting on that committee. And I think, again, it's designed to help us to bring more expertise to solving some of these collective problems and to develop the capacity of our working relationship with our colleagues at SMAST. Jim's talked about the work that is being done with HABCAM, which is also a joint exercise between Science Center and SMAST researchers. So I'm not going to revisit that. The other item that I had on my agenda to talk about here was this question of observers and electronic monitoring, and I think we've already had a discussion of that, so I don't think that I need to revisit that. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's my report.
Thank you. Questions of the Science Center? I see Dr. Pierce and then Mark Gibson. I got you.
Not a question, just an elaboration. I wanted to call the attention of the Council to the correspondence section of our binder or on the web, if you're on the web. And this is a letter from Dr. Karp to Paul Diodati, my boss, the director of the Division of Marine Fisheries, co-director of the Marine Fisheries Institute, and Dr. Stephen Lorenz, who is the dean of SMAST. I was at that scoping session regarding discussions of a review of the Northeast groundfish stock assessment process. It was a very well-done scoping meeting. We had excellent participation from the center. We also had a representative from the regional office, Dan Morris, and he was very, very helpful. Very pleased with the way in which you, Dr. Karp, are moving forward with us to deal with these extremely important stock assessment issues. The letter was written perfectly. A wonderful example of the center in particular, the center's support of moving forward to improve the stock assessment process. So we anticipate that these workshops will be held fairly soon with involvement and with some direction, of course, assisted by the center and the regional office. And I anticipate that we'll have some very worthwhile products sometime before the fall, maybe even earlier. So thanks again, Dr. Karp, for your involvement in this process, and also, John, for your office's involvement as well.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Karp, I wanted to return to the subject of the flatfish survey initiative you spoke about, and you're probably aware that the Science Center conducted a winter flatfish survey for over a decade. And I believe that was done, you know, with more bottom trending flatfish gear. I also believe it was discontinued because after some side-by-side evaluations, it really wasn't generating anything new or in addition to what the spring-fall surveys were doing with the standard gear. It may have caught a bigger pile of fish, but the trends were largely the same. Age compositions and size compositions were the same. So we've heard an awful lot about the perceived inadequacies of the the new vessel, the new survey gear, particularly as it relates to flatfish. Given that you've already gone through that exercise once before, I understand that, you know, the public relations need to talk about this, but I'm hoping that there, you know, a new flatfish survey on industry platform is really going to generate information in addition, or possibly new or different relative to the agency surveys, and I'd just like to hear some more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, I think these are good questions, and the questions that we're working on in the light of what we did learn from the survey that was discontinued, questions that we have now, and how to move forward in a stepwise and deliberative way. And in the short term, we want to do work which is really focused on survey gear performance, and we've got some ideas, and so do our colleagues at SMAST on some experiments that can be done to elaborate on that question. There's some ideas about bringing video gear to play and to better understand what the interaction is between the gear and the flatfish. In the longer term, your points are well taken. We do not want to establish and invest heavily in a new time series until and unless we can see that there is potential there. And among the ideas that we're discussing are, of course, the area that the work would be conducted in, the need perhaps for information in a season other than the seasons when the regular multi-species bottom trawl surveys are being conducted, those kinds of things. We're in the early stages yet. And what I hope we can do is design some preliminary work that we can do later this year to help us focus more on precisely what it is that we might achieve with this kind of an exercise. I am keen to work closely with the industry and to recognize what they can bring to the process. But like you, I am also concerned about how we invest our limited resources in providing information we need to support the stock assessment. So these are all things that are under discussion.
John Bullard.
I want to pick up on both Mark and Dave's comments. It was in September, I think, where Bill Karp hosted a one-day session probably half a mile up the road in Portsmouth between members of the industry and scientists on improving communication between the industry and science. And I think kind of late in the afternoon, a member of the industry said, you know, I wish I could remember who it was because it crystallized for me kind of a goal. I said it would be good if we could get to a point where if the science does deliver a message that is bad news. And I think we get that every now and then. That instead of just retreating to our corners to just argue, we would just get to a point where we say, okay, here's what it says, let's get to work. That there would, because the process was one of engagement, the process was one that had built understanding and trust, that when you looked at the results, you would just say, let's get to work. We have some decisions to make. And so Bill is at the center of the storm, trying to get us all to that point. And so, Dave, as you talked about that session at SMAS, it involves lots of people because we've had this culture that is far apart from that goal, and lots of people have to participate in moving us towards that, because we do waste a lot of energy and time that we don't have. And so whether it's flatfish surveys with industry or whether it's the working relationship with SMAST and MFI and the Science Center, trying to find ways that we improve things, all of these work towards that goal that this person crystallized, that, hey, if we get some results, can we just get to a point where you look at them and say, right, let's get to work. And I just want to commend Bill for trying to engage all the right parties in meaningful conversation where people tone down the defensiveness and say, hey, we can all do better. We can all spend more time listening respectfully. We can learn from one another. And we can all do a better job if we're respectful, if we have some humility. And everyone's playing a role at this. And that was September. Now we're in January. And I think, based on his report, based on, you know, things like what you just mentioned, Dave, you know, we're making progress. We're not there yet, but we're making progress, and it's just a few months.
I've got Jim Kendall. You got your hand up, and then we'll take a break and come back, finish up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting. I just wanted to comment on Dr. Kopp's presentation. I'm heartened to hear what he's got in mind here for the future with the industry and the surveys. He had told us early on at the first meeting he had with New Bedford Industry that this was part of his goal, so I'm happy to see that it hasn't gotten lost in the ensuing months. I have one quick question here of Dr. Weinberg. You mentioned about the gear testing that's about to occur in February. Can you give us a little more information as to what gear and what the testing is involving?
Yeah, I have a little bit of information, and if this isn't adequate, we could go to Rob Johnston in the survey for more details. But I have that the ecosystem survey branch was awarded 4 sea days aboard the Bigelow in February, and they will be technicians will work with the ESB staff to calibrate and tune the SIMRED ME70 bathymetric multi-beam sonar and the RAP Heidema autotrawl system. And they will also be working on modifications to the fish handling system.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that last part.
They will also be working on modifications to the fish handling system, which is when the fish come on board, how they're moved through the belts and processed.
All right, but there's no gear comparisons or anything to that effect. All right, thank you.
Okay, we'll take a 10-minute break. If we want to come back at 5 minutes of 11, and then we will start with Laura.
Actually, it was more of a comment for John.
It was for John. Well, we'll just see when he gets back in. Any well, other?
I mean, I can make the comment. Okay. I think it's also for Dr. Karp. John commented that we waste a lot of time questioning the science and that we're not acting in a timely fashion. And I just want to make the comment of what came out at the groundfish meeting was that we as a council could be more involved in setting terms of reference on species such that we aren't questioning and going back. For instance, in the Gulf of Maine cod assessment, suddenly we have an FRF at 50, where it's always been at 40. And so now we're saying, hey, you changed the terms. Go back and calculate it consistent with the mortality of 0.4 and an FRF of 0.4. So I would just encourage the council to continue to develop its role in providing clearer terms of reference so that we could have more buy-in, because we sat at that groundfish meeting and many of us at the table didn't buy into what we were hearing.
Dave Cathel.
Yeah, just briefly, wanted to touch on a couple points here. I too was pleased to see this letter this morning from Dr. Karp to MFI. I think that's what we need. We need a neutral forum to discuss some outstanding issues that a lot of people have. I think that's a good way forward. The second one was on the flatfish survey. I hope that you can find a way to come to the Gulf of Maine and do a few tows up there. We'll certainly be happy to tell you, depending on what time of year you're doing it, where you could get high concentrations of flatfish to get some good comparative tows. And the last one was on white hake and the status. I know we are undergoing a stock assessment now, and I just wonder what the timeline was for that white hake assessment, when we were going to get the information.
You can answer. And I don't think that Jim is there right now, and I can't answer the specific timing question on the white hake assessment, I'm afraid. We need to wait for Dr. Weinberg to come back into the room.
John Quinn.
Yeah, I just want to add my kudos to the collaboration and the moving forward. I think, it's good to see that collaboration hopefully is going to replace competition in the different agencies working on these things. So, while I can't speak for SMAST, I work at UMass, and I think I'm thrilled that this collaboration is going to move forward.
Okay. Unless there's burning issues, I would like to continue moving through the reports. Is there any Mid-Atlantic? Frank?
Yes, thank you. Mid-Atlantic Council met in mid-December. It's usually the busy meeting for the recreational issues. This year, probably the number one topic was sea bass, kind of took front and center. Service closed on emergency action November 1st, the black sea bass recreational fishery, because it was estimated that their quota had been exceeded for the year. Mid-Atlantic has an AM of a pound-for-pound payback, which was expected to take place in 2013, and because of the overage, it was enough that there may not have been a fishery in 2013. But it was also determined that it wouldn't be until, I think it's next April, before the numbers are finalized. So it was determined that the overages could not be applied until 2014 at the earliest. The council also requested that the SSC reconsider the recommendation for the 2013 biological catch, which I understand has been done. And if I'm correct, Mike just told me moving it from Category 4 to Category 3. How they might want.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the final report, so I'm not exactly sure of the rationale. But my understanding is that by agreeing that the stock assessment information is sufficient to reach Category 3 as defined in the Council's risk tolerance policy, that's basically the change that the SSC made, and that has an effect on the available quota.
Okay. And that hasn't been to the council or anything yet, so that's just, there is some news coming down there. And they also asked that the Science Center conduct an operational assessment of black sea bass this coming year and to have that available in October of this year before the management measures for 2014. I think I got that correct. They also voted to start an omnibus amendment to look at the AMs for black sea bass on the recreational side and also for other fisheries because of the pound-for-pound payback, and also realizing that it's done on a survey as opposed to the hard catch data. They'll be working on that hopefully sometime in June. Well, at the there's a June meeting. At the June meeting, they'll have that, and hopefully the regulations will be in place for 2014. And there is some discussion on whether or not that would be retroactive or not. And I know the RA asked if there was a way for that to be figured out. So that'll be reported at the upcoming meetings. Summer flounder, the council and the commission met and decided to go with conservation equivalency. And that's about the same as it's been for the last few years. Recreational harvest limit would be 7.63 million pounds. SCUP, the board also voted to do the conservation equivalency in state waters for 2013. Federal waters, they recommended a 10-fish size limit and a 30-fish possession limit, which is considerably better than the last few years, and an open season year-round. The states will develop state-specific measures, and there's normally a four-state region, and I'm not sure when that meeting is going to be, but that'll be coming up, and that's New York and the states to the north. And that was it for that. Amendment 15 to the river herring and shad. The council got the results from the scoping hearings and decided to move forward with the amendment, so they'll continue working on that. Amendment 8. The council took action to institute a butterfish cap closure authority for trimester 2 so to ensure that trimester 3 fishery will be maintained. The council also voted that NIMPS has the discretion to shift butterfish cap and landings back and forth at the end of the year to optimize the fishing regulations. There was a squid workshop on January 15th and 17th. I don't have the results of that. I'm not sure if anybody here was at that meeting. And they spent some time in the special management zones off the coast of Delaware. The council's been working on that for probably about a year now, where the states have requested on some of the artificial reef sites to make them special management zones. And that was the bulk of the meeting. Is there any questions, or if Howard has anything to add?
Terry.
Yeah, I guess this would be a question for you, Howard. What is the timeline on the development of Amendment 15? And I ask that because I'm looking at our herring priorities for this coming year, and one of them is to prepare an amendment to consider river herring and shad stocks in the fishery with a to-be-determined timeline.
I don't have it in front of me, but as I recall, mid-2014.
So I guess to rip into Paul or Paul/Tom, we should probably talk to Chris and Rick and put together a game plan.
Further questions on that? Jeff, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the council. I'm Jeff Kalin. I work with Lens Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey, a family-owned company. We've got a dozen boats and work in probably 20 different fisheries in a processing plant in Cape May. We employ about 75 full-time people, and that doubles when we have fish in the plant. On the stocks and the fishery issue, if you know, the national standard guidelines tell us that we have to have be able to I can't think of the term of art, but we have to predict ACLs, AMs, and so forth, and they have to have reference points. But the stock assessment for river herring that everybody's looking at, I guess,
right now to determine whether river herring should be listed as endangered or not is specific about the fact that there's not enough data to develop reference points, which is why we've been arguing stocks in the fishery isn't an appropriate way to go for either council, because I don't know what you're going to do. The data doesn't exist. We're hearing that there's a problem with the estimates, the river herring estimates, and one of the reasons for the delay in the listing is because there's no smoking gun. The problem on river herring doesn't seem to be reverberating in the data. So I think it's a little difficult to assume that any council is going to establish river herring as stocks in the fishery in the 2014 fishing year when we don't even have enough data to estimate reference points. So, you know, we've said it, and Pat Kirkel said it, there's nothing that we can't do in the herring FMP and the mackerel FMP to protect river herring and minimize the catch of river herring as an incidental catch, which the law requires us to do, and I would submit is what we're doing with 14 and 5. So I hope that you'll focus on the science behind whether or not we're causing a biological problem with river herring, and I'll submit that the science doesn't exist to even make the determination. So we are put in a very difficult position, a handful of boats. We're the so-called smoking gun, but there's no data to support that. So that's the comment I wanted to make, and I appreciate being able to take the time to do that. Thank you. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify to the council, we, Rip and I, have communicated our concerns about river herring as a stock in the fishery, and we've communicated at NRCC, and we have to look at it. It's a result of the lawsuit. So that doesn't mean we have to consider river herring as part of the stock in the fishery and how herring, nor does it mean the Mid-Atlantic have to consider it as part of mackerel. But there are a number of issues that if one of the councils does consider it, then we've got to decide who should manage it. There's a tremendous workload about ACLs and AMs. So we have been in contact with the Mid. They are scoping to get public comment. I hope the public comments would be forthcoming to them, and that we would provide comments to them. And we, too, have on our priorities to look at it. But there's a number of issues that the service will have to get involved in before it can a plan can be developed, including who should have lead responsibility.
Howard, I saw your hand up. Did you have a comment? You're all set? Okay. Mary Beth.
Just on that status of the Mid, Paul, at the next Mid-Atlantic Council meeting, that amendment is on the agenda, and the staff will be providing an update just to be clear on that they're clear on the direction the council intends to go with the amendment. But from what I understand, I think scoping is over at this point. I'm sure it's not the last opportunity to weigh in as it develops, but just to clarify a little. So, and if anybody's interested, you can go online and listen to that discussion.
Anyone else on this? Okay, we will move on to the Coast Guard, Captain DeCola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I deliver my report, I'd like to acknowledge Commander Kurt Verkaitis, who's sitting in the audience. He's currently the commanding officer of the Coast Guard Cutter Campbell, homeported at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard here in Kittery. But he's received orders to my staff recently, so he'll be joining us in Boston coming this summer. So we're very pleased to have him on board and have him in here for a preview of the council. He was here last year as well. On the enforcement side, I'm going to apologize. These slides are dated by a few hours. The Coast Guard Cutter Grand Isle is right now escorting a groundfish trawler into Gloucester that was found fishing with a netliner, very similar to the netliner I showed you pictures of back in September. So they'll be met by a no enforcement agent at the dock in Gloucester, and will be reviewing and pursuing a catch seizure. So for the 372 boardings that we conducted between November 13th and January 29th, 2013, We have five violations, which is probably somewhere around 98.6 to 98.5%, which is similar to the compliance rate of last year. But, again, this case is significant, and more details to follow. On the safety side, the same boardings, we issued 51 violations to 32 individual vessels, a compliance rate of 91.3%, which is probably it's the highest compliance rate I've had the privilege of reporting to you, and a lot of that is due to the requirements in the Authorization Act of 2010, which mandated safety exams for all commercial fishing vessels. We also terminated seven voyages for lack of safety equipment during the time period. During the time period, we've also handled 61 search and rescue cases involving fishing vessels with the various 22 equipment casualties, 18 fire flooding or running aground, 11 sunk vessels, and 10 medevacs, assisting 106 fishermen, and sadly, three fatalities involved with the sinking of the vessels Twin Lights and Foxy Lady 2. Marine casualty investigations have been initiated and are currently ongoing for those two vessels. Finally, with respect to the fishing vessel safety exam decal requirements, we had a very busy year in 2012. We did about 150% of our normal inspection workload and issued about 120% more decals, more than we normally do. With all that work, we were awarded on the 20th of December, Congress passed and the President signed into law the Coast Guard Maritime Transportation Act of 2012, which overrode the requirements in the Coast Guard Authorization Act of 2010, changed the date for the mandatory safety exams for fishing vessels until October 15th of 2015. And the law also changed the requirement for biennial safety exams to every 5 years. However, it should be noted that the two-year requirement remains in effect for vessels carrying observers. So for more information, fishsafe.info is your best bet, or contact your local fishing vessel safety examiner. So that concludes my report. Happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Howard, and then Dave Gatel.
Yes, thank you. Were those changes made for budgetary reasons?
Not exactly sure. I couldn't answer that definitively, Howard. Sorry.
Dave Gatel.
I have two questions. One is for Captain DeKohler, and the other is actually for counsel. The sinking of the two general category scallop vessels. My understanding with the Twin Lights, which was a boat that had a mooring right next to me for 15 years, so I know the boat very well, they were tangled up in a lobster trawl. Is that correct?
That's the report I received, she wasn't fishing on a general category license. She was fishing on a state license.
Okay. The reason I ask this is it brings up an ongoing problem, and that is the fact that we have really two competing laws here at the moment. One is the whale safe stuff, which requires less and less buoys and longer trawls, and the marking requirements, which we really refuse to deal with. You have people now fishing 20 to 40 trap trawls. You can't see from one end to the other of them. They have no radar reflectors, no buoys, no nothing. And if you tow into the middle of one of them in a boat the size of the Twin Lights, or in my case, I'm a little bigger than the Twin Lights, you are in an incredibly dangerous situation. If you're in, you know, I got into one in the dark here a couple months ago in about 60 fathom of water. You're lifting thousands of pounds of weight off the bottom on one side of the boat or the other. I mean, my boat's a lot bigger than the Twin Lights in terms of it's a little longer, but it's a lot bigger platform. It carries a lot more weight. But, you know, I almost had a scupper underwater before I could get that gear up. It doesn't break. I don't understand how you can be using lobster gear with rope that's so thick that a boat with 400 horsepower can't snap the rope, but you can't snap it. I mean, I tried. I tried putting a boat up wide open, trying to just break the thing in half so I could get my gear up. So we have a very dangerous, looming safety situation here that has the potential to sink a lot of boats
because you have gear that's not marked in any way, shape, or form that you can see it. And like I said, my understanding is that these whale requirements are lengthening trawls. You know, there used to be 5 trap trawls, then there were 10 trap trawls, and like I said, now there's between 20 and 40 trap trawls being fished inside the Western Gulf of Maine. And so I just want to call the council's attention to that, that, you know, something has to happen here pretty soon, or we're going to be, you know, going to some more funerals. And the other sinking, we still don't have any determination on that, but my understanding is that parts of the boat have been located on Middlebank. Is that correct?
I couldn't comment exactly where they were located, but parts of the boats have been found, yes.
They have found some, and so, again, there'll be some kind of a casualty, hopefully casualty determination as to what might have caused that sinking.
Yes, the investigation's ongoing, so
okay.
it would be presumptive of me to comment on
that. Yeah, no, it's presumptive for me as well. I just, you know, again, I'm just going by what I've heard. My second question is on this issue of these liners. Now, this is the second one that's been reported. The first one, I'd like to know if there's any update that can be given to us. Has there been any charges made, first of all? And second of all, the issue of how this relates to sectors. I asked this question 4 or 5 council meetings ago, I believe, when we first found out about this issue of joint and several liability and sectors when, you know, some person of ill repute is caught doing this. How does that affect the rest of the people in the sector?
So with respect to the vessel in September, an EIR was issued, and we'll have to ask Frank to provide us an update on where that's at. And with respect to joint and several liability, the enforcement committee hasn't met on it yet, but I would offer that if you're part of a sector and you receive an EAR, it's almost like telling your parents. You're going to have to fess up and tell folks. There's no requirement right now to provide that type of information to the sector managers. And I'll defer to Logan, but if we're looking to investigate further, we're certainly not about to provide information to anybody outside that investigation.
Okay, I appreciate that. I'd just like to actually hear what I'm concerned with as a person who's in a sector is that I can't control the actions of an individual, and yet I just want to know whether or not the rest of the sector is liable for these people doing the kinds of things that now, I mean, I thought the original one was an extremely isolated incident, and I hope never to hear of one again, and now I'm getting a sense that there's a pattern developing here, which very much disturbs me and you know, may, you know, has serious implications potentially for sectors.
Gene, do you have a comment on that? Or?
Enforcement attorney in the audience, Frank Spertel, to see if he has any insight into this. You know, it is a decision that would have to be made on an individual case, and so if Frank could speak to that, that would be the best way to answer the question.
I guess I'm, yeah, and I was asking it as to the impacts to the sector rather than the individual operator. Is there recourse to the sector?
You mean in the enforcement?
No. Once this person is determined to have been in violation of a rule, is it just on that individual, or is there liability on the sector as well?
That's what Frank can speak to.
Okay, thank you. Frank.
Good morning. It's my understanding that it would be the vessel owner and operator that would be jointly and severally liable, so it wouldn't reach the sector. So I don't know if that, Dave, that answers your question.
Yes, it does, because that's the concern of people in the sectors, is that they can't be responsible. You know, it's a violation of a sector operation plan. It says you'll fish with legal-sized mesh, and you know, they don't want to be liable for some guy who goes out and breaks the law. So it does answer my question. Thank you.
And to the question that you also asked about the Netliner case that Captain DeCola reported on earlier, that's with the Office of Law Enforcement. They're working that case package up. I don't have that case yet, but
that's obviously a high priority for us to deal with.
Thank you. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recall that several council meetings back, we had the meeting about the inconsistency between gear marking in state waters and federal waters, and it turned into a huge project covering two councils and ASMSC, the council, and it just didn't make it at priorities because it was so complicated. But I think that when we make these type of issues to cover gill netters, long lines, everything, it becomes very complicated. But if we want to attack just the lobster, we should send a letter to the feds who manage lobster and have lobster requirements for marking in the EEZ, and a letter to the ASMFC who manage in the inside state waters and say, we want you to be consistent. There's a safety issue here. And just, address that one as opposed to trying to do everything. So I think a simple letter can get things moving concerning the lobster gear, which seems to be a problem.
Anyone else on this? Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up to you, David, on the ground lines. It's the requirement in the whale plan is not on the length of the trawl. It's on the requirement to use sinking ground line. Most of the lobstermen have replaced the floating ground line with very heavy sinking ground lines. I think that's the strength problem you're dealing with right now.
And again, I don't know lobster rules that well. Wasn't there also something about reducing the number of end lines? I think that's being interpreted by a lot of fishermen to let's just string more traps together in longer and longer gangs.
The effort to reduce the risk to end lines is still under development. It has not been published as a final rule yet. That may be in the future, but it's not in the cards right now.
Okay. Again, I'll just reiterate for everybody. I mean, in our effort to save the whales, we may be killing the humans. There should be a maximum length on the length of a trawl, at least in west of the Western Gulf of Maine closed area, where there's very little bottom that draggers can fish already, because it's and I agree with Paul. I think a letter should be sent requiring some kind of marking requirements. There is no reason for buoys to be half a mile to a mile apart, and quite frankly, the seagulls that are sitting there on the water are bigger than the buoys. You just can't see them.
Okay, thank you. Terry?
I just wanted to say, in the gillnet business, we have a mile. We're 6,000 feet, right? Or 5,000 feet. 5,000 feet is the longest string that we can have, so a mile long. So that's quite a distance to see a buoy. But we have, radar reflectors and everything else. Big buoy, so.
Okay, move into Dr. Weinberg.
Yeah, at the beginning of after the break, I believe there was a question that I could have answered by David Gafel, and I just wanted to respond to that on the timing of the White Hake assessment. Yeah, David, the peer review will be the February the 19th to the 22nd, and the SARC panel will provide its summary report to me on March the 15th. And then the three reports from the individual CIE reviewers is due to me on March the 29th. If the results coming out of the summary report indicate that there's unanimity among the panelists, then it should be shortly in the later part of March when I'll be releasing information to the PDT on the results of the assessment.
Thank you very much. That's what I was trying to figure out is how it fit into our current status of the stocks and what we were doing here tomorrow. So the answer is that this will be available after we set those stock numbers. So we'll be setting them based on the current assessment for White Hake. Is that correct? Okay. Thank you.
BMS and law enforcement, Logan and Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep my report fairly brief in the interest of time, but obviously happy to answer any questions with regards to anything that's come up here today. I'm going to skip to the last page of our council report for the first quarter of 13. Just to point out that our total number of incidents are significantly up from last year, 251 this year as opposed to 179 last year. And although we haven't submitted any cases for prosecution to the Office of General Counsel, we have issued approximately 31 summary settlement cases in the first quarter of 13. To Dave's topic most recently, we are going to be hosting a discussion panel at the Maine Fishermen's Forum with regards to gear conflicts between trawlers and lobster gear. We're hoping that we can get some members of the industry together and parties together to maybe work some of these issues out between themselves as well as, you know, if we can improve the regulations or whatever we can do to mitigate these instances. We're trying to bring these parties together, so hopefully work that out. The other thing, I don't know if my slide came up. The main thing I want to present today is the fact that our draft enforcement priorities have been published for 13. I just wanted to put this slide up so everyone has the opportunity to comment and where to comment. While I'm more than happy to take comments myself, I would actually prefer that they go through this process here so that everything's collected in one spot. But throughout the year, I'm open to suggestions and hearing comments from the council or members of the crowd behind me. This is not just for comments from the council. It's for comments from anyone, from the general public, members of industry, whoever would like to comment on what our draft enforcement priorities are for 13. We'll be doing the same thing in 14. This is our second year doing this. The comment period will be open for 60 days. It closes at midnight, March 24th. And hopefully we'll get a lot of comments and input, and we'll be able to make some adjustments if needed. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Any questions for law enforcement? Terry.
Not specific cases, I'm sure, but I'm just curious what type of incidences are we occurring right now?
Well, the majority of them are Magnuson Act incidents. And by incident, it doesn't necessarily mean enforcement action was taken. It's just where we were engaged in some sort of situation, whether we received a complaint. We may or may not have even followed up on that complaint, but we received a complaint. Boardings, inspections, dealer inspections, dockside boardings, at-sea boardings. Majority of those summary settlement cases that went forward, those were mostly border inspections with regards to lobsters coming across the border from Canada. But I could get more specific information if you need it.
Frank Blount.
Yes, thank you. This is more of a comment. The comment period is going to end on March 30th, I think you said, and we'll probably have a enforcement committee meeting between now and then. The problem is the full council, once again, doesn't meet till April. So it's just something we're going to have to consider how we're going to deal with that, the comments from the committee.
Yeah. Well, I think we have in several instances simply said that normally the process is bringing it back through the council, but when we have that kind of a deadline, I think without objection we would task the enforcement committee and their staff to craft a letter and to run it through Paul, and then it would go out. Anybody object to that? Okay. Thank you, Frank, for bringing that up. Bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and council members. I'm Bill Semro. I run the Northeast VMS, or Vessel Monitoring System, program within the Office of Law Enforcement. The Northeast VMS team is currently monitoring 1,014 vessels that are registered in the Northeast program. Of these, 510 are ground fish sector vessels, 26 of which are currently on a power down letter of exemption. And there are 114 common pool vessels, 8 of which are on a letter of exemption. Following extensive testing, I recommended, and Dan Morris, acting on behalf of the regional administrator, approved the new VMS unit for use in the Northeast region for all fisheries requiring a VMS effective January 24th. The VMS unit is called the Thorium TST-100, and it's distributed by CLS America in Lanham, Maryland. The Thorium uses the Iridium satellite network for communications. And for more information on the Thorium VMS, the phone number for CLS America is 301-925-4411. And the email address is fishing@clsamerica.com. There will be a Federal Register announcement published very soon. This is the fourth VMS unit approved in the Northeast. The next unit I'll be looking at is the Faria Watchdog 750. Faria is out of Uncasville, Connecticut. And my second and final topic, I want to say a couple words about the Foxy Lady 2 that was mentioned earlier. Of course, we did unfortunately lose this VMS-equipped vessel, the Foxy Lady 2, 45-foot general category scalloper. On December the 15th, it reported its last VMS position early that Saturday afternoon while north of Provincetown. I did see a few public comments regarding the vessel and the VMS system, and I want to say a couple words on behalf of the agency regarding VMS, what it is, what it isn't. It's important to keep in mind that VMS was not designed to the standards required of a distress system, nor is NIMS structured to maintain a 24/7 ops center to monitor VMS real time. For several reasons, some VMS positions sent by vessels are either never received by NIMS or are received much later than expected. For the 11-month period from February through December of 2012, we looked at VMS vessel positions received or expected to be received while they were at sea in the Northeast fishery. What I mean by at sea in the Northeast fishery is that they were seaward of the VMS demarcation line. And there were about 3,072,000 positions that we received. And this, again, is from all Northeast VMS vessels in the fishery, not talking about vessels that are dockside. Of these over 3 million positions, about 23,600 positions that we received took more than 2 hours to arrive. We call these latent positions. Now, this means that a NIMS technician or a Coast Guard watchstander monitoring the vessel's VMS track line in real time would not see the expected position on their monitoring screen for at least 2 hours. There were also at least another 9,372 positions that were expected but never received. We call these missed positions. The total of these latent and missed positions is 33,000. It's a very large number in trying to manage some kind of a response. But in terms of enforcement monitoring, those 33,000 positions represent slightly over 1% of the total positions that NIMS received. It's a relatively small percentage, which is well within the published NIMS standards for VMS equipment. These standards allow for up to 3% of the total positions received to take more than 15 minutes to arrive. And I just want to end by wishing my shipmate fair winds and the calm seas in his future endeavors. Paul, all the best to you. And this completes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Bill. Questions? Dave Gatham.
Bill, can you give us those numbers by vendor, or is that confidential?
Dave, I don't have those numbers by vendor, and I would probably have to vet that through OLE to see if I could do that. I could develop the data by vendor. I don't have it with me, and then I'd have to make sure I can actually share that at that level.
That's fine. I'm just wondering if there, again, is one particular operation that's creating the majority of the problems, or it's evenly spread out, or, you know, what the situation is with why we're getting that kind of numbers.
Right. I will say I don't think it's any secret, because it's been brought up before, that the vendor SkyMate with the Orbcom satellite network is the one we generally see the majority of latency issues.
We're going to move on to ASMFC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go fairly quickly here in the interest of time as well. The Commission has not had a quarterly meeting since the last report out to this Council. There have been two meetings of note. One was a meeting of our Summer Flounder Scup Black Sea Bass Management Board with the Mid-Atlantic Council, and I think Frank summarized that very well, so I won't rehash that. The other was the Atlantic Menhaden Board met on December 14th and made a number of substantial changes to the Menhaden Management Program that the Commission has. The overall catch of Menhaden is going to be reduced by about 20% relative to the last 3 years' landings. There's a state-by-state allocation system. There's improved monitoring. And it also set up the ability for the managers to react to new stock assessment information. So it's kind of a major shift in Menhaden management along the Atlantic coast, and it was a big issue. And we received 128,000 public comments, so it was a highly publicized and highly political issue as well. So the next quarterly meeting of the Commission is February 19, 20, and 21. There are a couple meetings that will be of interest to folks in the room, likely. The American Lobster Board is going to meet and continue to work on their Southern New England Lobster Management Program. They're going to work on a lot of the trap transferability provisions that are currently in the ASMFC plan. They're also working on some of the offshore closed areas and interactions with the council activities that have occurred recently. The sea herring section is going to meet and essentially react to decisions that are made later this afternoon by the council on sea herring quotas for 2013 and beyond. The winter flounder board is going to meet to approve an addendum for public comment that will allow the winter flounder managers to essentially react to the state water sub-ACLs that are established by this council. In the past, the commission has kept its state water regulations fairly static, but now that the sub-ACLs for state waters are changing from year to year, the commission wants to be able to react to those and increase or decrease fishing opportunities relative to those changes in sub-ACLs. So those are some highlights of the meetings that's coming up in about 3 weeks, and I'm happy to answer any questions or give more details on those if folks would like me to.
Thank you, Bob. Question? Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, just one additional thing. Bob Beal did a good job summarizing what's happened and what is coming up shortly at the end of the month. There's one board meeting that is of interest to this particular council, certainly to the National Marine Fisheries Service, the center specifically, and that's a NEMAP board meeting. I'm on the NEMAP board. NEMAP, of course, is the survey that has been underway for quite a few years now with the fisherman's vessel, Jimmy Rule's vessel, with VIMS. And we are going to be reviewing the NEMAP progress to date with the hope that we will get ourselves into a position where we can say with great confidence that NEMAP is actually putting us in a position to come up with indices of abundance for these important species that the New England Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council manage. NEMAP is an important tool now for the Northeast Fisheries Science Center in light of the limitations of the Bigelow, so working cooperatively with the center that's involved with NEMAP. We hope to see where we stand relative to NEMAP progress and where we are right now and where we need to go. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, Bill, I can't recall who's on the NEMAP board representing the center. You might want to touch base with that particular person so that you're brought up to date as to what sort of information we're going to be looking for from the center.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, I was just wondering how the commission is doing with allocating the federally caught dogfish with federally permitted vessels and the federal EEZ and allocating it to states, how that's going.
Paul had to get in one more states versus the feds issue here, Paul.
I wouldn't be happy if you didn't. The commission hasn't modified its dogfish plan in a couple of years, and I don't think there's no management actions in the works at the commission right now. The Mid-Atlantic Council is actually modifying the way the federal water allocation occurs in the federal FMP, and that would mirror the current ASMFC plan. So as the Mid-Atlantic moves through that process, hopefully at the end of this we end up with allocation plans that are identical between the state plan and the federal plan.
Anyone else? Thank you, Bob. We're going to move on to NROC. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I will be lightning quick. I have three main points that I want to make to you all. First of all, so my name is John Weber. I'm the Ocean Planning Director with the Northeast Regional Ocean Council. As many of you know, we are continuing basically to build our information base that is for regional ocean planning. That has taken the form of various types of maps and talking to people, shipping, energy, fishing, boating, et cetera. We are appreciative to all of you who have been involved in our work to date. Also just noting that we especially thank those of you from NIMS, from the Council, and from the Science Center staff who have agreed to help us out with a project we're starting now that is looking at data and information related to natural resources, species, and their habitats. More to come on that. We had a formal meeting of the entity that will have responsibility for carrying forward the regional ocean planning effort. They met back in November of 2012, Doug Grout as the council's representative to that entity was present. Their next meeting will be April 11th and 12th. It will be in Rhode Island. It will be, I think, a full day on the 11th, half day on the 12th. I think that's Thursday and Friday. One of our main focuses, one of our main efforts, has been, as many of you know, mapping fisheries. So we've been conducting a series of meetings at various venues and really appreciate everybody who has helped us with that. Conversation pieces that we have gotten into, when we look at some of these maps, what's missing, what else do we need? Importantly, what are the caveats we need to have in mind when we're looking at the data that, or the map products from the data that we have? And as you remember, it's a lot of that is derived from VMS and VTR data. And importantly, then, thinking through our next steps. These meetings will really be occurring through the next couple of months at this stage. We're midway through them. If I could get the next slide, please. So just as an example, I think now we're looking at this as scallops for 2007 to 2010. So what we've done to date is gone from on the upper side, you can see basically the quote-unquote raw data, and done some work to analyze that data very simply to develop a sort of heat map, shows areas of more or lesser activity in the bottom right. That is an example of the type of map that we're carrying forward. Next slide, please. And we're talking to people about, here's a similar version based on groundfish, the multi-species fishery. Next slide, please. Those first two maps were basically an example of the type of products we're starting to work on deriving from the VMS data. This is an example of VTR type of work that we're doing. This is dogfish looking at a couple of years, and we're looking at, in this case, you know, from VTR you can pull out catch versus trips. It tells you a couple of different kinds of things. So my point is that these are the kinds of maps that we're bringing out and really trying to engage the industry with. On a final point we have brought the team who is working on this with us, which includes folks from the Island Institute, Rhode Island Coastal Resources Center, and George LaPointe. That team is here today, and we're going to be setting up these maps that you saw, plus a whole pile of other ones, in the Gardner Room of this hotel, starting at about 4:00 today. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for, you know, helping us to coordinate with that. We understand fully that, you know, there's a council meeting, agenda items will be happening today. But just to let folks know, if things adjourn early and before festivities start tonight, we'll be set up in the Gardner Room with these maps and would invite council members plus know, anybody else in the audience to come down, take a look, see where we're at, et cetera. Again, Mr. Chair, really appreciate your help in helping us to organize that. And that is what I have to say.
Thank you, John. Questions? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just a quick one, John. If you could go back one of the slides to your heat map, so to speak. All right, that one would be the locations of all of the vessels, whether they're fishing or not, right? Because it looks like a lot of that red is just where the vessels are steaming. So you'll have maps that are actually more refined in terms of the intensity of the heat, that is, where the vessels are actually fishing as opposed to steaming.
That's absolutely right. And so a couple of points on this. The VMS data that we have, it does not have the specific timestamp information so we could calculate speed. Certainly, if you could calculate speed, you could make some assumptions and start getting at your point that way. And I think we're going to be talking to, going back to NIMS and talking to them about getting that raw data, because that's an important issue. It has also come up when we've had meetings with fishermen, because they're automatically going to that very same point and starting to indicate, you know, on areas where it's not obvious, where different types of activity are happening. It's, you know, transit versus fishing versus sorting catch, working on gear, that sort of thing. So starting to get some of that information also in these meetings we think is really important. But you're absolutely right. The raw maps that we have right now, it's just greater density of locations of vessels, not necessarily their activity. Well, certainly in some areas you can guess what they're doing.
Anyone else? Thank you, John. We are now going to have an update from Ingrid Bearden. Biedren, if I hope I pronounced that correctly, on her work on EBFM.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hi, I'm Ingrid, and I'm a PhD candidate at Cornell University, and I'm studying the ecosystem-based fisheries management and how the Mid-Atlantic and New England councils are addressing that issue. And I thank those of you who have already participated in my project through interviews for your help. And I'm here today to ask you one more time for your help with the last phase of my research, which is a mail survey. So the survey was sent out a couple of weeks ago to council members, staff, SSC members, and some fisheries stakeholders in the New England and Mid-Atlantic regions. So we're hoping for as many contributions as possible to represent all the different perspectives that might be involved in this issue. And so we'd really appreciate it if you would be willing to take the time to complete the survey. And if you, for some reason, didn't complete it, but maybe are thinking about it, Cornell will be sending out another copy of the survey to those of you who didn't respond the first time. So I will be here for the rest of the meeting, so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be very brief. Last week, Ted Platzner, 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 last week, Ted Platz